the Empire Podcast this week, we talk texting and chips with Felicity Jones, star of The Last Letter from Your Lover. And we try to get Stillwater star Matt Damon to not say anything controversial. See how that goes. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has been binging loads of episodes of Superstore recently. And at the request of dozens of listeners, well, okay, one listener, has been working on an impression of the store manager, Glenn Sturgis. That's the Jesus! There you go.
Wow. That was...
Nailed it!
I mean, I've heard worse impressions.
I nailed Glenn!
That was pretty good.
What do you mean? That was a good one! The one before was also good! What do you mean I have a Muppet voice? Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, after a return to the live arena that was hailed as overlong and self-indulgent by those people at Total Giggling Idiots magazine, we are back in the virtual pod booth. And speaking of giggling idiots, I am joined, as ever, by my two colleagues of such lethal cunning, Geek Queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello. At least I have also watched Superstore, so I have some idea what's going on right now. I pity those who do not.
Yeah. James is lost. Our great big totally fucking lost. Nerd, James Dyer, is totally lost. I am quoting a TV show you have not seen. Suck it, you pilot prick.
It is true. We do not cover whatever in the name of all things unholy that is on the Pilot TV podcast. Explain it to me, Chris. So you're doing which Muppet? I'm confused.
No. Comedy, James. It's Superstore. It's a sitcom.
Yeah.
Is it? It's a situation comedy.
Yeah, it's set in a superstore and it's about the workers. It's actually secretly like stealthy super left wing.
Sounds dreadful.
So I love it. But it's also very funny.
Yes.
Yeah. Not the politics of it, but just the idea of it.
No, other wings are available. No.
Yes. But No, I've never watched it and I don't understand your reference.
Okay,
no.
Good. But trust me, I fucking nailed it. Anyway, welcome to the podcast. How are you both?
You know.
Yeah.
High energy, raring to go.
Yeah, woo! We're really excited. I love that Helen's backdrop, obviously none of the people listening to this can actually hear this, but we are doing this via Riverside, not Squadcast this week, the Pilot TV recording studio. You are guests in the Pilot TV studio. How are you finding it? Is it nice? Is it roomy? Is
no,
it airy?
No, it's good. As in, I just noticed that you can have up to 5 people in here, so you can fit you, Boyd, Terry, and both of your listeners in, so that's nice.
Solid gag. It's good. Good luck. Yeah.
So they've doubled their listenership. That's really impressive.
Thank you, Helen. Yes, Keith now has a girlfriend. So that's essentially what's happened.
Keith.
So I'm just going to point out that Helen has redecorated. And not only do we have a small model of, is either one of the gentlemen from Buffy or Mary Poppins, I can't really tell. But also, Helen's book is in pride of place facing
it
over
is.
Her shoulder.
Oh, and oh my God, that yeah,
you are
is.
Such
absolutely
a shameless
self-publicist.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I actually, that bit of that shelf is all of my books.
Is it?
That love of it along there, yeah.
What do you mean all and of your that, books? How many have you written?
Like 3, plus a comic book, plus I did a foreword for somebody else's book, so I put that on the same shelf.
It doesn't count.
Hang on. You're including, you did a foreword, so you're including that as one of your books.
I'm putting it next to mine as I transition out of my books into other people's books,
I
you know?
I see.
Yeah, and that's actually a little Zoltar, the fortune teller from Big. That's
oh no, I meant the one on the other side with its,
oh,
with its
here,
arms akimbo.
That's me as Black Widow.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So one of the gentlemen from Buffy or Helen is Black Widow. Yeah,
wow,
you can see
that's
I
a little
that
offensive.
Yeah.
Are you suing Disney or are they suing you? What's happening here?
No, this was a promotional thing for the Winter Soldier. Do you remember? James has a Winter Soldier of himself.
I do. That's actually 100% true. Yes, I have a little me as the Winter Soldier.
And didn't you get one as well, Chris?
I did not. I was not there for whatever that was.
Well, we had the whole office done. Do you remember the entire Empire office was done in miniature? We were all 3D printed. So we all went down to the studio and had little models of something. They put them all in a big glass case and then removed them as people left. But they said you can come down in your civilian clothes, but you can bring one prop. So I can't remember. Chris, did you have like Hulk fists or something?
No, I had someone else had Hulk fists. Did you not have Hulk fists? No, you had a sword.
I literally brought a broadsword with me and the studio was across London. So I had to carry this broadsword on the tube across London. It's astonishing I didn't get arrested.
I brought my snooker cue with me. I brought my pool cue with me.
You did, that's
right.
And they hated you for it because it's like quite thin and spindly. Your pool cue, I should point that out.
I did also have my penis out in fairness.
And that's quite difficult when they do the... When they do the 3D model, that's quite difficult for them to, because it breaks.
Hmm. Yes.
I bought a stack of fantasy books.
Of course you did. Hang on, and I'm the great big fucking nerd.
Yes, because you brought a broadsword, James. Yes. I mean, that's nerdier.
Could you go like full meta and schedule another session where you bring a model of yourself. And so they have to make a miniature model of yourself. Then that
holding
miniature model,
model of yourself is holding a miniature model of yourself.
Yeah, oh, and so on and so on and so on. Ad infinitum until the whole thing breaks and the singularity is revealed as a sham.
That's what Christopher Nolan would have done.
We've incepted ourselves by accident. Oh, God.
Such a shame. I did have that, not the Black Widow or Winter Soldier one. That was a different session that I wasn't part of. But I did have a model of myself with my pool cue, because we used to have a pool table in the office back when we had an office. And this was a different office, in fairness, before we moved to the depressing hellhole that is Camden. And then we had a pool table in our office.
Felted in Empire Red.
Shaftesbury Avenue. It was in Empire Red. And I spent a lot of time in that pool table.
You did.
But I was, it has to be said, fucking brilliant. Anyway, enough of this pool and model nonsense. There's no three-fact structure you'll be delighted to know this week.
Hooray!
Oh, shame. Oh, dear.
I think we have, in a way, delivered our own little factoids about ourselves in this faffing bit. So instead, we're going to launch straight into the listener question, which this week comes from Curator John, a regular question contributor. Mm. But he comes up with a good one this week. Not to say that he hasn't come up with good ones in the past. Anyway, whilst I'm digging myself out of this hole, hey, the question is, what do you think are the best and worst disguises in movies? And this is in relation to Black Widow and the workaround, the cheating in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where people can suddenly look like other people and they don't really talk about the technology or how that works. Not going too much into spoilers there, but yeah.
It's fine. It's like computery mask technology stuff. Totally makes sense.
They borrowed it from Mission Impossible.
They're borrowed from Mission Impossible, 100%. Of course they have, Which is why, you know, I think the best makeup in movies has to go to someone else, because I feel like those are all using like super high-tech stuff that mostly doesn't exist, with maybe one or two exceptions in Mission Impossible's case.
It's cheating.
It's cheating by using like high-techness.
Yeah,
absolutely, it is. Yeah. I think the best ones are mostly cheating, though, because my answer would actually be Zoolander.
Yes.
Do you remember when Derek and Hansel, who's so hot right now, managed to get a basic makeup kit just from Hansel's pocket or something and turn themselves into completely different people of a completely different age, ethnicity, you know, everything?
Yes.
That is impressive makeup to me. That's what you need.
It is. Yes. That is a fantastic bit of disguising. Well done, Derek and Hansel. Finally, they're good at something. That's just before the files are in the computer sequence, isn't it?
Yeah. In the computer? The files are in the computer?
Yeah, great stuff. Yes, good one. That was on my list. That may be definitive. We may have a winner already.
I mean,
Jimbo.
Is it on a level with King Shark's disguise in the Suicide Squad? I'm going to say not. I'm going to say when that moustache is in place, you cannot tell that he's a giant sentient walking shark at all on any level.
Fake moustache.
but that would not be my choice. My choice would probably be, if we're discounting the Terminator, which you've got to be honest, is a pretty good disguise, I would go with another Schwarzenegger. I would go with Doug Quaid going through customs in Total Recall.
Yes.
Oh,
for a holiday
yes.
lasting, how long, yeah. Chris?
Two weeks. 2 weeks, which then I always segue into the Emperor at that point. Two weeks. Yes, that is a cracking one. What's a Terminator disguise?
Well, you know, he pretends to be a human and he's actually a killer robot from the future.
What?
Because he has like a skin suit.
Hmm.
Because he's in disguise. Because he's an infiltration model, Helen. That's his whole role.
I'm really intrigued, but I don't think we ever saw enough of the, you know, the mechanics underneath that. Like, does he have to ingest some food to kind of keep the, you know, the biological
only McDonald's.
Bits alive?
That's
really.
That's
Are we sure about that? Though?
Yeah, 100%. Mm. Big Macs.
Okay.
What it is. But T-1000, you know, of course, is better at it.
The T-1000 is better at disguises. Like, I think that's just. Fair to say.
Even he, though, I think can't hold a candle to Sister Inviolata and Sister Euphemia from Nuns on the Run. I think you can say Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle were absolutely indistinguishable from actual nuns.
Couldn't tell them apart, honestly.
No,
is that a nun or is that Robbie Coltrane? I still can't tell to this day. Every time I see a nun, I think that might be Eric Idle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, yeah, Whoopi Goldberg disguises herself as a nun, doesn't
also
she?
Also, a lot of nuns in disguise.
In Ghost.
Yeah.
A lot of nuns.
And Jumpy Jack Flash. No, of course, Sister Act and Sister Act 2, back in the habit.
Mrs. Doubtfire, I 100% bought Robin Williams as an elderly Scottish lady.
Absolutely. And look, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, while we're talking cross-dressing, I mean, they are phenomenal in Some Like It Hot.
Yeah, just nobody mentioned White Chicks and I think we'll be fine.
Yes.
Oh, God, let's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, we should mention White Chicks because the makeup there is just exemplary, isn't it? The same with Martin Lawrence in Big Mama's House, where the actor just disappears into prosthetics and you can't tell. You just can't tell. The nightmare fuel that's on screen in White Chicks is just amazing. Lenny Henry in True Identity.
Yeah, True Identity.
Someone who has to change his identity an awful lot. Fletch, Chevy Chase and Fletch does an awful lot of disguising. He's not like Pistachio Disguisey, the master of disguise, who can effortlessly pass himself off as anything that you like, including a deeply unfunny film. Turtle, unfunny movie, it's all there. But yeah, Fletch does some really interesting disguises. And I often wondered where he got the knack for that.
Didn't you get trained in that at journalism school?
I missed that module. I must have been the same thing with the Black Widow and the Winter Soldier model day. I must have just been off.
It was in between shorthand and Quark Express.
Yes, I miss Quark Express as well, and I'm not very good at shorthand. So the less said about disguises, the better, quite frankly. But hey-ho.
Speaking of masters of disguise, the master of disguise, clearly a legend in his own field.
Yes, I just mentioned him.
What turtle?
Dana Carvey. Pistachio Disguisey.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, is that what... Yes. See, I've never watched the film. I've only... Because it looks too horrible to contemplate.
It's absolutely horrendous.
I didn't know that was his name.
A true nadir of comedy. If you think The Love Guru was bad, then check out Dana Carvey in Master of Disguise. It's awful beyond belief.
What about that time in Mission Impossible that we were in... Was it the Russian general, where it is actually Tom Cruise in a mask before he takes off the mask? Like, it's not a completely different person.
In the first one.
One of them. Yeah.
In the first one.
Is that Russian general?
It is. Well, it's a general of some description. At the beginning, in the opening of Mission Impossible, when he's on the TV show and it's Tom Cruise in the mask. But that's just Tom Cruise in the mask. It's not meant to be Ethan
Hunt
in the mask.
Not Tom Cruise in the mask.
No, not Tom Cruise in the mask. But that's Tom Cruise in... So is that Tom Cruise? Is that meant to be Ethan Hunt in the mask? Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Well, the entire time. So it's Ethan Hunt in the mask right from the off... But he looks like Tom Cruise wearing prosthetics.
This is confusing. So is it also Ethan Hunt as Les Grossman in Tropic Thunder?
Do the same thing that I have assumed ever since Darkman came out in 1990, in that every movie is a Darkman sequel. I know I've said this before in the podcast, but it is a theory that you cannot disprove. Okay, you cannot disprove this theory that at some point in every single movie made since Darkman, Dr. Peyton Westlake is in the film, and there's no way you could prove otherwise.
I feel like, I mean, he's very tall. I feel like we'd notice.
He is tall.
Time, Takatito, time. Yeah, No. He's Darkman. He melts into the darkness and he can assume the form of anyone.
Hang on, are you just inventing new powers for him at this point?
I don't think that's how that works.
Yeah, he crouches.
Yes, he hides behind things.
Yeah, so he was Meryl Streep in Mamma Mia. He was Danny DeVito in Hoffa. He is everyone and no one. He is everywhere and nowhere.
Mm. If we're on excellent disguises, can we please talk about Clark Kent for a minute? I mean,
yes,
come on.
We should.
Yes.
I mean, that's like She's All That levels of non-hidiness.
Oh, we're going to be talking about that today. Exciting.
Oh, or are we? Or He's All That.
Yes, exactly. But it is fantastic. You've probably all seen that clip that went around of Christopher Reeve getting into and out of Superman character. And you can tell who he's playing at any moment, even without, the glasses coming off or the suit changing. He's astonishing. That disguise is almost believable, despite the fact that they look identical and are the same person.
Yes, it's wild, isn't it? We've said it before, but it's a masterclass in acting. Mm. That, just the way his posture changes, the way he's more erect as Superman. Stop it. It's fantastic stuff. And it's all because of the glasses. The glasses, the right choice of glasses as well. I can't not mention Inspector Clouseau. Because as the Peter Sellers Pink Panther movies went on, they were sort of flailing around a little bit in terms of comedy. I think that's fair to say. So they started just sticking Clouseau into a series of disguises. I remember him as an overweight Frenchman. I'm pretty sure it's that scene. It's a very, very famous scene. I'm not sure which Pink Panther movie it's from. They all blend into one for me. But it's a scene where Sellers gets into a lift and he's in this disguise with people and he's basically playing an overweight French country bumpkin, if I remember rightly. And he gets into the lift with all these fellow actors, and there's a very, very famous outtake where someone, possibly Sellers, just lets off a series of extraordinarily loud farts, and everyone just cracks up. So, Clouseau. But obviously the guy with Clouseau, his disguises were always a bit shonky and a little bit shit. So you could tell it was Clouseau because he was rubbish. So I'm going to say Clouseau. I think the best disguise, Henley may have nailed it with Hansel and Gretel in Zoolander. But I'm going to throw in Dr. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, who makes good his escape from the jail at the end of the movie by slicing off a security guard's face and draping it on his own, and then essentially just pretending to be an injured man. And then that's how he gets out.
And that, I feel like that was just like a dry run for Face Off, which is, of course, the correct answer to this question.
Yes, it's uncanny how much they look like each other there. Totally uncanny. Even their wives don't notice. Yeah. What's that about?
Arguably the worst movie disguise. There are lots of movie disguises where people don't really try. They don't really bother. And that's played for comedic effect quite a bit. You know, Lando Calrissian in Return of the Jedi, who disguises himself at Jabba's palace by just basically wearing a mask, you know, but one that doesn't even hide his face particularly well. You think they would know what Lando Calrissian looks like, but maybe they don't have sketch artists and stuff.
Maybe they don't get Capes Monthly, where he's been a cover star six times.
Maybe they don't. The Joker in The Dark Knight, who infiltrates the hospital by simply putting on a terrible wig and a nurse's uniform.
It's quite a good wig, I'll be honest. It's a very sexually confusing scene, that. I don't know how I feel about it.
Is that, you mean you're sexually attracted to the Joker? That must really be, you know, keeping you up at night. Not in a sex way, but...
No, I don't know. He's carrying off the wig pretty well. I just think he looks good in it. I don't... Look, I'm talking it through with a therapist. I'm sure we'll be fine.
Wow, Helen's like a dog chasing cars. She wouldn't know what to do with one if she caught it. But I'm going to say possibly the worst disguise of all time in the movies is James Bond in You Only Live Twice.
Oh, God!
Where Bond goes to Japan
and
has to go undercover in Japanese society.
Oh no.
And so disguises himself as a Japanese man. And it's problematic, shall we say. And to do this, he brushes his toupee forward a little bit. And the pit of my stomach falls when I see Bond do that and You Only Live Twice. Anyway, all right, listen, as ever, these things are not meant to be exhaustive. I'm sure we're missing out loads of glaring examples. And if you are shouting at your podcast listening device of choice right now, calling us idiots, well, guess what? You're absolutely right. But do write in, do let us know, do engage with us on the Twitter machines. I'm at Chris Hewitt. Helen is at Helen L. O'Hara. And James is at James C. Dyer. So just shout at us in a polite and nice way, obviously. And, you know, ingratiate yourself. Don't just call us twats. So if you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, and why the hell wouldn't you after that, then you can get in touch with me on the aforementioned Twitter. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to any of my tweets, or you can just wait for a panicked shout out every now and again. Time now for our first guest. Felicity Jones is the star of movies like Rogue One, The Theory of Everything, and Like Crazy. She was Oscar nominated, of course, for The Theory of Everything. And now she is one of the stars of the enjoyable romantic melodrama The Last Letter from Your Lover, in which she plays a crusading journalist trying to find out the truth about a mysterious love affair. I caught up with her on Zoom last week, I think it was. Everything's blended into one, for a chat about her approach to acting, journalism, and chips, of all things. Hey everyone, it's Chris here, jumping in real quick before the Felicity Jones interview begins to tell you that there's a little bit of a spoiler in this about the end of The Last Letter from Your Lover, which is a movie that I guess, you know, it is what it is. It doesn't have a huge deal of surprises up its sleeve. It's not built on twists. But if you don't want to know what happens in the central romance in a movie, then perhaps only listen to this after you've seen the film. Enjoy. Hi, Felicity.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Whereabouts in the world are you at the moment?
I'm in London, in Soho, in fact.
Is that an actual hotel room behind you?
It is, yes. The real deal.
I'm so used to Zoom backgrounds and virtual backgrounds and all sorts of stuff.
It's weird to see a hotel, I know. It's retro, in fact.
Have you been ordering room service? Have you been going wild?
Oh my God, have I been ordering room service? Yes.
It's the little things. I miss room service. I miss hotels.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, I never thought I'd say that I would miss it, but I have. Yeah. As you say, it's definitely a joyous occasion to be able to order room service these days.
What's your room service game of choice? What's your go-to option?
Well, I have just ordered some French fries, so any minute now, my snack of choice would be arriving.
Well, listen, if the interview gets interrupted and the door bangs open and it's someone bringing you a whole bunch of French fries, then that's fine.
You'll understand. Understand.
I'm totally okay with it. So congratulations on the film. I mean, it gets you there, doesn't it? Proper tearjerker, but in a very kind and nice, uplifting way, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got sort of an old-fashioned sweeping romance to it, and as you say, that is very moving. I think the fact that it's an enduring, long-lasting love, it really gets you when you see these characters when they're much older, and that love has remained. Yeah. But then it's obviously told through this contemporary lens, through this two people trying to figure out love in a contemporary context.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you are the facilitator of that, your character, Ellie, and you are I think crusading journalist is the right term for it here. And, your character digs deep, confronted with a problem, confronted with a mystery, digs deep, uses all your powers of research to get to the bottom of this mystery as a journalist who basically just goes on the IMDb and quickly Googles someone. I was in awe of Ellie's techniques. Was it like being a crusading journalist? It's basically what I want to know.
I was going
to
say, the scenes where she just goes on Wikipedia, we got rid of those scenes. Like, she probably needs to make a little bit more effort for this film to be engaging.
Yeah, she's got the bit between her teeth.
Yeah, exactly. No, she's, it was interesting. It's interesting talking to contemporary journalists and just making sure that, because obviously technology is so much a part of journalism now, and Twitter it was quite a fine balance actually getting that feeling of, what the story needed was her kind of boots on the ground type journalism, but also making it feel like it was present day. And I was speaking to a journalist who said much more, because there were more scenes actually originally set in the office where she was writing in the office. But journalists, I mean, this was pre-pandemic, but journalists much more are home base these days and will probably write at home, and you'll just go into the office for a meeting with the editor. And we were sort of trying to make it feel as sort of relevant and contemporary as possible, but also keeping that Ellie does have that drive and gets personally involved in something and goes to the house of the person that she's writing about.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I kind of did do that stuff when I was starting off before I detoured into this nonsense. And I did start off as a proper journalist. I would, talk to people and, do court reporting and I did do the hard yards, boots in the ground. And that's a very interesting aspect of the job.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, I think it's a rite of passage, isn't it? For many journalists, you do have to start literally interviewing people in the street and then you sort of, build from there. But Ellie's very much at that point, I think, where she's quite determined and wants to, she's looking for professional and personal fulfillment and finds it when she discovers these letters and finds this story.
Mm. So not to bang on too much about the journalistic aspect of this movie, but it always strikes me that actors, the way you throw yourselves into research feels very journalistic. In fact, I think sometimes more journalistic than most journalists will ever experience. I was listening to a recent interview with Jason Isaacs, where he was talking about all the various people he's played over the years. He's played squatties and drug dealers and all, killers and people like that. And he's often found himself being paired with people whose real life experience will inform his performance. And he said that those people will be much more open with an actor than they would with a journalist. Is that something that, do you feel the same way? Do you interrogate roles in the same way? Do you look at it as that deep dive? Is that part of your process, so to speak?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just seeing if my chips have arrived.
I noticed you getting distracted. I was like, I realize this is a very long question, but
but now you know. I was very honest in the beginning.
No, go for it, honestly.
I think that's interesting that people, I don't know, I think it takes, I think it's trust, isn't it? And I think people, if people's lives are being put on screen, then they've entered into that and they've decided that they're okay with that happening. So, I mean, if I'm playing real people, then it's sometimes not dissimilar to the process of being a journalist. You're looking for the story. You know, what is the story of this person's life? Why have they made these decisions? How have they got to this point? So you are looking, you're looking for the story. Yeah. And it's interesting when you speak to people trying, people have very, they come back to the same stories over and over and over again of their life, you know, as they get older, and trying to get people off their sort of off the beaten track of their anecdotes and getting underneath and around. And that's always quite quite key, really. But I find just by spending time with someone and just, yeah, I mean, building up trust with them, that they feel like it's going to be okay if you're going to be playing their life story.
Because I imagine it's obviously very different playing someone like Jane Hawking or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where there is such a wealth of material outside of, you know, whether or not the real person is still alive or you can meet the real person.
Yes.
But then Jyn Erso, for example, which is where your imagination runs wild. So how do you even research something like that? That's always interesting to me.
Yeah, I feel like you come at that from a slightly different angle, that that was very much, I came from a more physical route, interestingly, that she, I felt like she had been a bit like a street fighter and she'd brought herself up and she'd been she'd had to be quite physically aggressive in order to defend herself throughout her life. And then that was informed with the kind of training I did physically and doing a lot of martial arts and that kind of thing initially, and then doing boxing. And so I sort of came at that from a slightly different direction than obviously playing a real person, which becomes more about reading and autobiographical and maybe a slightly more academic approach.
And when does preparation for a movie begin for you? Is there like an anointed day? So for example, you get a part in a movie. Do you go, all right, okay, I've got this part now, I'm going to start work next week? Or does it start right away for you? Or is this something that happens more gradually?
It's funny. It's sort of, I think it, you want, I always like to have, you know, time to let something gestate and live with it. And it's not nice if you feel like you've only got, you know, a few weeks. I don't find that a comfortable place. I think you want to live with that story. You want to sort of, without sounding too pretentious, kind of meditate on it. You want to slowly find your way into it. And then often you'll be doing some kind of either physical training or voice training or dance. You know, there's always, I find there's something you're having to adapt your, you know, your physicality or your personality in some way. And so the longer you have to do that, I think the better.
Yeah, there's usually something in a role that you're doing for the first time. Is that?
Exactly, exactly. And you've got to make it look like you've been doing it for years and years.
Yeah, precisely. Like texting and this. But I'm sure you text quite a bit.
I mean, that was 7 months of training. Just to get the specific movement of the thumbs and so that was one of the hardest things I've ever
had. How do you do it? You've got to make it look so effortless. That's the thing.
Exactly, exactly. Actually, I have to say, one of my favourite things is typing on keyboards in films and making it look like you're actually writing something when you're just writing gobbledygook.
Are you actually writing something?
Nope, I'm sorry to tell you, but the joy is in making it look like you're writing something.
Oh my God, okay.
Well, you just tap, tap, tap.
All right, some of us would write something, Felicity, that's all I'm saying. Some of us would actually write something.
More dedicated.
Yeah, you know, but hey-ho. You obviously, as well in this one, you are executive producer, and I know that you have recently set up a production company. So is that something that is becoming more important to you as well?
Well, I just found that seemed quite a natural thing to do. I had studied English literature at university and I'd always been interested in storytelling and initially had, you know, I'd wanted to go into all different aspects of filmmaking. And I obviously started acting when I was quite young, and then that was sort of my route into it, I guess. So it's felt more and more that I love the idea of building a story, and I love the from start to finish, the whole arc of making something. So it's just been something that I've you know, naturally enjoyed and has sort of developed over the years.
Can you talk about how hands-on you were as an executive producer in this one? Is that it? Were you there throughout the process with Augustine and the writers as well?
Interestingly with this film, the executive producer credit, I guess, is sort of formalizing a process that often happens, particularly when you're playing leads, which is in terms of script discussion, talking mm-hmm. to the writer, you know, having that early connection and that relationship and being able to affect some changes early on means that I feel that you can build a much, much stronger character. And it was a very, just by the nature of the people involved, it was a very collaborative, open process where Shailene and I were given a voice in the whole process of the film.
Obviously, you and Shailene have a director in common as well. You both work with Drake Doremus.
Yeah. And actually, from that point, from doing Like Crazy and being in a film that was all improvised and obviously as the cast, you're technically writing it as you go along. I think that had always given me a sense of, oh, I'd love to, you know, try some other different roles out in terms of filmmaking.
Okay, so what stage are you at now in terms of the evolution of producing? You've got your company, which is Piecrust, if I'm right in thinking that. So Piecrust Productions, that's a heck of a name. What's next for you? Do you have any active projects that you're looking to get off the ground there?
Yeah, very much. We've optioned a book by Lauren Bukes called Afterland, mm-hmm. which is about a post-pandemic world where men haven't survived. So it's an all-female world. So we are in the midst of development on that. And then we have various other projects in different stages. But I mean, if there's sort of anything that we're looking at, there seems to be a root of it is always looking at, defiance in some way seems to be if there's a theme, you know, initially, not that it's ever that kind of concrete, mm-hmm. but in terms of the roles that I've played before, I generally am sort of drawn to quite sort of defiant individuals.
Yes.
And there's definitely a strain of that in the work that we're doing in terms of producing.
Is that, was a mission statement in a way going into Piecrust?
Yeah, I think just a point to come back to. I mean, I think what's exciting is you never know what kind of things you're going to be doing and where you're taken. It's a very instinctive process. But I think at the root of it, there is the defiance is a strong element of it.
I've got to ask about Piecrust as well as a name for your production company. Where did that come from?
That was, well, pies are great.
So, yes, they are, you know. Especially with chips, room service chips.
Exactly. Very tasty. But also it is, it's the type of collar, which was originally worn by one of the former defiant individuals, Elizabeth I. So it's a very intricately designed and crafted type of collar, stand-up collar. So that's that's a bit of a inside information.
Absolutely. You know what? I'm going to be one of those journalists who goes to Wikipedia and Google after this again. I'm not just going to go to IMDb. I'm going to Google Piecrust after this because I have to see what one of those looks like. and I've got to let you go in a second, but I did want to ask about, because obviously the way this film is structured is very, very interesting. You're in the modern section and you have Shailene and Callum, by and large, are in the 60s section. So did you guys intersect at any point? Did you have any days on set where you were just passing each other in the corridor going, hey, how's it going?
We unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of interaction. I mean, we had, Shailene and I had a couple of days where we had scenes in the same location that they would dress, obviously, for 60s and for contemporary. So we would be in the makeup trailer at the same time. But interestingly, initially, Callum and Shailene were going to play their older selves. And then it was quite a massive leap age-wise. Yeah. So the older actors who play them brilliantly came in to do those roles. And so that meant that there was, you know, rather sadly, there was no chance for us all to act together.
I mean, yeah, because it would have been maybe a bit much of a stretch with the old age makeup and whatnot.
Yeah, you can sort of do a certain amount, but you don't want to get, when it gets where there's too many prosthetics, you can lose a bit of the essence of the story and the focus.
That is a good call. A good call indeed. And listen, on that note, I'm going to let you go and enjoy your room service chips.
Fantastic.
But I got to ask the biggest question of them all. Ketchup or mayo?
Both. Both, mate. Both.
Get out of here, Felicity Jones. It's ridiculous. Outrageous thing to say. Outrageous. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Athena.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so that was Felicity Jones. And now it is time for us to delve deep into the movie news that's been happening over the last week, or 9 days, more accurately, because we recorded last week's podcast on a Wednesday. So we missed everything that happened Wednesday night onwards, including fairly big news that we might have to tiptoe around a little bit here. But the news I alluded to earlier on in the show, which is that Scarlett Johansson, the star of Black Widow, the actress who's played Natasha Romanoff in the MCU for, let me just check my watch, 11 years now, is suing Disney about box office related bonuses that she believes are due to her post Black Widow, which hasn't done as well at the pandemic affected box office as I think people were expecting. Disney have countered with a very strong statement, to which then Scarlett Johansson countered with another strong statement. And I think that's pretty much where we are at the moment. And but there's lots of talk. This is a very, very interesting story in that you don't often see this happen. And there are rumors that other stars of Disney movies might also be considering their options as well, because certain movies like Black Widow and Cruella went to Disney Plus at the same time as the theatrical release. And so there's some suggestions that it may well have affected box office and profit margins and bonuses and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is going to come down to exact wording of contracts, to which pretty much none of the commentators currently talking about this, including us, obviously, are privy. So it's hard to work out exactly where the legalities lie as a result of that. For example, many of these contracts have arbitration clauses, which might be why we don't hear about this very often. It might happen all the time, but it goes immediately to arbitration rather than to open court, and we're never privy to that. There is, however, some interesting possibility here for kind of precedent, and I think it's the first sign of something that is bubbling in Hollywood and that is becoming a question, at the very least, for creatives, for crew members and everybody else, which is the fact that the streaming model has upended certain financial arrangements that have been in place for a very long time. So it used to be that you would get residuals, obviously, if your film was shown on TV or whatever else, way down the line. And that wasn't just true of big, big stars like Johansson. That was maybe true of crew members and smaller cast members as well. With streaming, the numbers are so opaque. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows how many people are seeing things. The streamers don't generally, or certainly don't consistently, release these numbers, and also their internal numbers, so there's no oversight and examination of them. So it's hard to know what you're getting, what you should be getting, if you're getting as much as you would have done. And it seems that people certainly feel that they're not getting as much as they would have done in the past. So I feel like whatever happens with this lawsuit, and, you know, Disney has all of the lawyers in the world going for it, and I'm sure, you know, Scarlett can afford a few herself, but seriously, it's an enormous, enormous collection of lawyers there. There is going to be more discussion of this, I think, in the months and years to come. Beyond the pandemic, it's not just about, you know, COVID delayed the release of Black Widow and then it went to Disney Plus. It's also about the entire financial system in Hollywood and how that's going to change, and how the model maybe at the moment is not serving the people who actually make the movies as much as it's serving the massive companies. So that's, I think that's people's worry. That's why this has gotten as much attention as it has. It may be that, you know, and I'm not saying that any of this is illegitimate or not above board. It's just that that's the model that's in place. And it may be that that's the model that's in place and everybody has to kind of suck it. But if so, I think there are going to be calls for that model to change. And it's a question of whether or not those calls will be answered by any of the studios.
Does this raise interesting questions about the status of movie stars as well?
Yeah.
And whether studios are now gambling on the idea that it's the IP that is the draw and not the star.
Oh, yeah. I mean, studios have been doing that for a while, I think. And look, I mean, that has, to some extent, there's a bit of symbiosis there, I think, with Scarlett Johansson. She was a star already. Like, she was unquestionably a star when she was cast as Black Widow. But there was definitely a sort of an aid to both of them. She became a bigger star and Disney, you know, gained a character who works brilliantly for them. There's been a really kind of positive symbiosis so far for both parties. The question is how that changes going forward. And I think this is the big issue. People are saying, well, stars don't matter anymore. I don't think that's true. I think the stars, there are certain stars who clearly have box office appeal in their own right. Yeah. And you see that when they step out of their franchise roles. But you also see that franchises have a life beyond a given star in many cases. So look, it's, I think the movie Star is Dead takes are overwrought. I think that the franchise model is flawed, even though I love Marvel movies. And I think that there is room for some kind of negotiation. Maybe not on this specific case. It may be that Disney are really genuinely determined to burn it all down in this case, or that Scarlett Johansson is determined to burn it all down in this case. I don't know. But I think we're going to see a bit more negotiation in terms of these things going forward, because I don't think it's as clear cut as all that.
Now, negotiation is kind of key though, isn't it? Because it's exactly as you say. It's not like the people saying, you know, oh, she already got paid X million. Why does she need more? But it's not about that. It's about good faith, isn't it? Like if a deal is negotiated in good faith for an upfront fee and then part of the back end, and then the back end is forcibly removed, then that's kind of, they've moved the goalposts and they should have renegotiated her deal as part of that. You would think, you know, if you have a relationship with a screen star, you know, it's a good faith relationship. You should renegotiate that. And obviously they didn't. And that's her issue.
And also, I mean, that argument is like, I mean, legally, morally, ethically, whatever you want to take it, it's nonsense. If she has enough money, Disney definitely has enough money. So, like, I mean, yeah, that can go hang.
Yeah, I've seen many arguments along those lines, and I think that argument is lacking in substance, shall we say.
I would suggest also that that's an argument that is leveled more against female stars than men. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case here, but we have seen that in the past. Demi Moore being christened Gimme Moore for getting $12 million for, was it G.I. Jane? At the same, or Striptease, in fact, at the same time that her husband was getting $20 million and was not nicknamed similarly. Yeah. You know, so... There is a definite double standard in the amount of standing up for themselves that women are allowed to do.
Of course, and and we're obviously getting in the realms of speculation. But again, I've seen many tweets suggesting that had it been, you know, RDJ or had it been Chris Evans in this same situation, that this wouldn't have happened. But it's interesting. You said, you know, Disney or Scarlett Johansson are determined to burn it to the ground. And a big part of our discussion on our Black Widow spoiler special, which is available now for all spoiler special subscribers, sign up just £2.99 a month, was this going to be her last movie as Natasha Romanoff? And I would say that yes is the answer now. It would take a, and also Disney might well point at the box office, which is disappointing. By and large, I thought this thing would top out at $600 million in a pre-pandemic world, and I don't think it's going to get anywhere near that. So they may point at the box office and go, there's no appetite for a Black Widow 2 or whatever else, or another Natasha Romanoff movie. So it's okay. We can burn this bridge.
I mean, I don't think she expects or wants to go back as Natasha. I think she feels, no, but even aside from the pay thing, I think she feels like, okay, that was my swan song to an extent. And I think there was a conscious sense, at least I thought so, of her kind of saying goodbye to the character in this movie. So I don't think that that's the issue. And I can absolutely see the studio and the star working together on something else again. I mean, she's had a very fruitful relationship with Disney over the years. Mm. And we've seen loads of cases in the past 10 or 15 years of stars and studios having a massive falling out and then still working together. Yes, these statements have been perhaps unusually strongly worded, but I think there's probably still a deal to be made, actually. And I don't think it's necessarily the case that everybody is going to burn the world. But I do think that there is a definite discussion here. Mm. And I think it's, even if this goes away and we never hear about this again and they never work together again and they all hate each other, I think we're going to see similar issues to this cropping up over the next few years, because I think there is some unease about the streaming model. And I think this is the first real open case of it.
Yeah, feels like a change is coming for sure. Let's move on to news that, oh God, this is going right into the pilot realm, but I guess we are in Pilot's virtual studio, so it all makes sense. Two TV show things to talk about. One is that we need a new Doctor Who.
Jodie Whittaker is hanging up the sonic screwdriver, and I didn't have to Google that. I know what a sonic screwdriver is.
Well,
it is a type of cocktail. And the Lord of the Rings television show released its first image this week and is going to premiere on Amazon in September 2022. Now, exciting? How do we feel?
Yes, exciting and utterly uninformed on both. So that's exciting. The Lord of the Rings show, we do now know, is going to be in the second age, not the third age of the one we see.
I'm
further,
glad we cleared that up, Helen.
I was on tenterhooks.
I know you are. So it won't be young Aragorn, because Aragorn ain't born yet. We're talking young Elrond and young Galadriel rather than young Aragorn. And the image that they released showed a person in front of a city. So,
yes.
Woo!
Yeah, they spared no details there. That was nice.
Was it Roland Riveron? Is that the name of the city? What's the name of the city?
There's a lot of speculation about what city it is. There are a number
Burnley.
Of contenders.
Burnley.
Sorry?
Burnley.
It's not
it was
Burnley.
Burnley. No.
You know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's not Burnley. Come and prove me wrong, Lord of the Rings. Come on. But no, we don't know exactly what city it is. There are a number of contenders, both elf cities and Numenorean cities. And it's going to be exciting to find out. I don't know. I don't know. I'm so excited.
Yeah, there was that panicked message from them. It was like, what are we going to do? We're not going to have time to do all these. And it was like, oh no, it's 2022. We're all good. We're all good. We don't have to worry about that as well in September.
I can't talk about Lord of the Rings and Wheel of Time and Star Wars and Marvel
too
all
much.
At once. Oh,
too
my
much
God.
Going on. I mean, look, that paled into comparison to the Waterworld news though, because like, I'm like, give me a Waterworld TV series, people. Give it to me. Dan Dish. Trachtenberg, Waterworld. Look, I know I'm out on a limb here. I enjoyed The Postman and I really like Waterworld. I have a weakness for Kevin Costner's extremely long runtime follies. And I liked the world of Waterworld. I thought it was fun. I would like to see this series.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, if they film in Hawaii again, I'm very happy to do this episode. But
sorry, I wasn't listening properly. A Waterworld TV show. Yes. Yes.
Of course, the benefit is that now that we moved on a fair old few years from 1995, they don't actually need to spend as much money because global warming means they could just film it, you know, at the seaside.
Basically anywhere, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I do love the... do you remember the story when Battleship came out? No, you probably don't remember much about Battleship coming out, but... I do,
poor Taylor Kitsch.
I do remember the director talking about the fact that basically he got a call one day from Kevin Costner saying, you know, can I come in and talk to you about filming on water? And then basically Kevin Costner just came in and lectured him and his team about all the things that are going to go wrong and just was giving them incredibly practical advice, like get two of everything, at least two of everything. If you can get three, get three. I mean, just going through every single thing that could possibly go wrong.
Which is why there are three Liam Neesons in that movie.
That's true. Yeah, you have to. Well,
because it is, of course, a Dark Man sequel. Dr. Peyton Westlake is Taylor Kitsch.
That was the same year that John Carter came out as well, wasn't it? Like, poor Taylor Kitsch. Taylor Kitsch, lest we forget, Tim Riggins from Friday Night Lights, which I'm rewatching at the moment and boring people's tits off on the Pilot TV podcast about. But he was so good in that show and he should have been this massive star. And I feel like that double whammy of Battleship and John Carter just torpedoed everything.
John Carter is good. I will defend that movie.
Is
John
it,
Carter is good. Yes, it is. The problem
Soviet
is that, you know,
Jeddak.
all the films inspired by it had come out first. So, you know, that didn't help. But anyway, we should talk about Doctor Who. Both Jodie Whittaker and Chris Chibnall are leaving at the same time. So showrunner and Doctor at the same time, which is unusual. Usually there's a bit of overlap one way or t'other. But,
presumably Chris Chibnall isn't leaving. He's going to transmogrify into another generation of himself. So.
Oh, okay then, cool.
Only James could say regenerate in 10 more words than it needed.
I couldn't remember the actual word for it because I don't watch Doctor Who. I was like, this is the thing where they do the wibbly wobbly thing and they become another actor. You know that thing, the timey wimey wibbly wobbly.
It's fairly famous. It's fairly well known that Doctor Who regenerates. And it's like,
sure,
oh my God,
whatever.
Doctor, what's happening to you? Oh, I'm transmogrifying into another generation.
Am I going to lose my great big fucking nerve credentials?
You might, actually. I mean, it's pretty important.
I don't like Doctor Who.
Look, it's interesting. It hasn't been, I think, a brilliant era of the Doctor. And I don't think that's because, you know, Jodie Whittaker is a woman. I think it's because the stories have not been great. The characters haven't had a huge amount of character development. You know, she's had three companions most of the time, but there hasn't been a lot for all of them to do. And it's just kind of felt diluted and ineffective for the most part. I don't think it's been a great era, so I'm looking forward to a new one, and I hope that we get something interesting. I do think it's hilarious, though, that immediately online people are all like, Neil Gaiman should be the showrunner, and then we could have A-list star as the Doctor. And it's like, that is absolutely not how the BBC works. And no. Neil Gaiman has like six other shows in development.
It's going to be Gary Lineker. They're going to keep it in the BBC. Gary Lineker or Graham Norton?
Nicola Walker. I want to see Nicola Walker.
I mean, I'm happy with any of those. It's going to be an interesting British actor or actress who can hopefully bring some eccentricity and some interest to the role. I don't know. I'm excited, though, to see them hopefully move on.
Yeah. I don't care, obviously.
But, obviously not.
Yeah.
Do you care about Nicholas Hoult starring in a film called Renfield?
Oh, what? Now we're done giving like baddies a sympathetic backstory, and now we're going to give sniveling little weasels a sympathetic backstory.
Oh. Hey, James is right here. Come on, man. Come on. Oh. Be nice. Yes, Nicholas Hoult is in talks to star in Universal Pictures' Renfield, which is going to be a movie based on Dracula's lackey. a Dracky, if you will. Who pops up very briefly in the books. It's been played memorably on screen by a number of people over the years. Tom Waits, for example, in the Francis Ford Coppola version. Chris McKay, the director of The Tomorrow War, is going to direct the movie, which is based on an original story outline from Robert Kirkman. Ryan Ridley wrote the script.
And we should point out this is, of course, a standalone theme because Universal have abandoned the world of gods and monsters.
Welcome to a new world of gods and monsters.
Now I want to watch The Mummy again.
Welcome to a new world of gods and monsters.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
That's it, Jesus.
I don't know who you are.
Do you know what? I watched The Good Mummy at the weekend, so maybe now I should watch The Bad Mummy.
The Good Mummy, is that like a spin-off from The Good Wife and The Good Mummy?
I was going to say, yeah. Julianne Margulies after death.
Fruit of the poison tree.
Oh, my God.
That was a great Good Wife reference. Come on.
Netflix, if you're listening, and I know you are, we are available to write and showrun The Good Mummy. Get in touch with us and we will make it happen. $400 million, please. Thank you.
Amazing. Yeah, no, Renfield, look, maybe it'll be brilliant. Maybe it will be absolutely brilliant and will change all of my views about...
Master, every day is Christmas Eve, Master.
Yeah.
But you remember they tried to make a character study of Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein's henchman, Igor, and they turned it into Victor Frankenstein, and it was great old big load of bobbins.
It wasn't the best film I've ever seen those two stars in, that's true.
James McAvoy and Danny Radcliffe.
Radcliffe. Is that where we're going?
That's what we're calling him this week, Danny Radcliffe. Yeah, not very excited about that. Yeah, what else? Are you excited about anything that's happened this week apart from people suing each other?
I am very excited about He's All That.
What's He's All That?
It's a gender-flipped version of She's All That. You remember the 90s rom-com with Kiss Me by Sixpence None the Richer?
Yeah.
I'm so glad I asked. Is that the, hang on, She's All That, Freddie Prinze Jr., Rachel Lee Cook?
Paul Walker as well, yeah.
Paul Walker? Yep. Oh, wow. Yeah, I barely remember the film. I much prefer the song.
I mean, it's honestly, it's not one of the best of that generation and was one of the very few effective jokes in Not Another Teen Movie. Where, you know, basically they have the same idea. It's basically around a bet. In the first
movie, Pygmalion, isn't it?
Freddie Prinze Jr. is this like super hot dude, captain of the football team, president of the student body, yada, yada, yada. One of his friends bets him whether he can turn an random girl into like prom queen.
Who looks like Rachel Lee Cook in dungarees.
Yes, the random girl that they randomly pick is Rachel Lee Cook with her hair in a ponytail and dungarees. And the one good joke in Not Another Teen Movie, apart from obviously, you know, the one with the whipped cream.
Hey,
is,
that's a funny film.
Anyway, is the bit where they basically look at all sorts of random candidates and then pick the incredibly hot person who just happens to be wearing glasses. So it's kind of the same thing here. They've chosen the incredibly hot person, in this case, one of the guys from Cobra Kai, Robbie Keane, who is just wearing a beanie and has long hair. And this makes him a hideous house beast, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just appalled by how ugly he was.
I mean, whatever. Rachel Lee Cook is in it as the who appears to be the heroine's mum, and Matthew Lillard is also, you know, cameoing after being in a small role in the original.
Star of Lizard in the Blizzard.
I mean, would be star of Lizard in the Blizzard. Yeah. So Mark Waters is directing. He did Mean Girls. That's got to be a good sign. But I mean, it looks totally ludicrous, and I can't wait to absolutely collapse in front of it on a Friday night.
All right. Very exciting indeed for He's All That. Very quickly, because we have to plug the new issue.
We do.
Mike Coulter. We like him, don't we?
We do, yeah.
We like Mike Coulter. We like Jerry Butler, don't we?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, they are going to be together at last in Le Plane. Le Plane.
Is it an action movie where a plane gets taken hostage?
Yes. So the plane centers around Brody Torrance, who I presume is going to be played by Jerry B, who, after a heroic job of successfully landing his storm-damaged aircraft in hostile territory, finds himself threatened by militant pirates who want to take the plane and its passengers hostage. Fuck off my plane, you bastards! As the world searches for the disappeared aircraft, Brody must rise to the occasion and keep his passengers safe until help arrives. And Coulter will play a cool-headed ex-military man named Louis Gaspard, who is being extradited to Canada on charges of homicide. I'm not making this up. I'm reading this directly on the website. When the plane crash lands on a dangerous remote island. So presumably then he and Love Jerry it. Team up to fight the pirates.
I'm so here
Love
for it.
It. Love it to death.
Highbrow, that's us.
Yeah. Want it.
Yes. When I hear that, I raise a highbrow. That's what I do. But I am still very, very excited about it.
You know what else I'm excited about?
Oh, yes.
Rob Savage, his new film Dash Cam.
Yes.
Rob Savage, who did Host, which was obviously the Zoom horror film. He's done Dash Cam, which is presumably shot through a car dash cam. It's another sort of tight, sort of lean film, 77 minutes long. Nice short one like Host. Exciting. Ooh. Exciting to see what's done. Apparently it's an idea he wanted to do before Host, but couldn't get off the ground. And obviously post-Host finds himself with a lot more juice.
He can afford a car.
And could afford a car with a dash cam, yes.
Yes. Everyone's suing everyone else this week, so I'm going to sue Rob Savage because this sounds not even remotely close to my idea, but close enough for me to throw a quick spurious lawsuit his way. This sounds like my idea, Satan Nav, which is about a sat nav that's possessed by Satan and tells people to go straight to hell. You know, okay. So it's, you know, the tagline is in 200 yards, die. That's good, right?
I mean,
you'd see that movie, wouldn't you?
As your lawyer, Chris, I would just say that you have absolutely no case, and I would advise strongly against.
No, but I'm trying to. But just by launching the lawsuit, people will start talking about Satan Nav and be like, "Hey, have you heard about this thing, Satan Nav?" And then let me go in 200 yards, die. And then Netflix would go, yes, please, here's a check for $300 million. Add that to the $400 million we got for The Good Mummy, and we are cashing out.
Ching, ching. Wow. Yeah. I mean, okay, I'm going to talk to you later about frivolous lawsuits, but otherwise it sounds like a flawless plan.
They're the best kind. I like a frivolous lawsuit. God. Right, so it is time to plug relentlessly the new issue of Empire, which is on sale right now in all good evil newsagents. And digital news agents as well. It is a cracking issue. On the cover of Empire magazine, in fact, inside as well, is a in-depth article about Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Muggins here wrote it, so apologies for that. But I spoke to loads of people from the movie, Simu Liu, Awkwafina, Kevin Feige, the director Destin Daniel Cretton, the writer Dave Callahan, and got the scoopage on what you can expect from this character that nobody, including, I have to say, pretty much everyone involved with the movie, had heard of before Marvel got rolling on Shang-Chi. So that's a fun bit of reading right there for you guys.
There's also my feature on Annette.
Ah, I mean, come on.
People might want to read that. I wrote things. You're a monster.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Can I say you haven't heard your own work or read your own work until you've heard it read out to you by a strange American narrator? If you're one of our American listeners, you'll notice that if you go into Apple News, at the bottom, there's a sort of little audio tab. It's only in America. There's an audio tab where you can listen to an article from Empire read to you by a narrator. And my Lisa Joy piece from the last issue is the one they did in the last one. And it is deeply, deeply upsetting to hear your own work read back to you by an American narrator. Just saying that. I can't remember which one they did this issue, but maybe it's yours, Helen. Who knows?
Nah.
Oh my God. That's terrifying.
It is.
What else in the issue? So yes, Helen, you spoke to everybody involved with Annette, didn't you?
Pretty much, yeah. Laos Carax, Adam Driver, Marion Cotillard, and Sparks themselves.
Yes.
Russ and Ron Mayo. So that was really exciting and terrifying. We also have in there, we have a look at the Warriors. We have a tribute to the late, great Richard Donner. We have a sort of spoiler special on the end of Loki, which is very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Not to be confused, of course, with our spoiler special podcasts on the end of Loki, which you can listen to. Might as well double down on the plug-in. If you subscribe to our spoiler special channel, as I say, it's just £2.99 a month or £32.99 for a year. You will get all our Loki spoiler specials, including interviews with Kate Herron, Sophia DiMartino, and the man himself, Tom Hiddleston. So I cannot recommend that highly enough.
Absolutely. We also spoke to Jennifer Hudson about Respect, principally, mm-hmm. her take on Aretha Franklin's life. And there are pieces in there on Leonardo DiCaprio and Esther Williams, the fantastic swimming mermaid of the MGM era.
Yes, indeed. Lee Isaac Chung in my section. We break down Cruella with Craig Gillespie. We rank Richard Donner's best movies as well. There's other stuff. There's a first look at The Harder They Fall, the all-star Western, which was announced this week as the opening film of the London Film Festival. There's tons and tons of stuff. Emilia Clarke is this month's Pint of Milk and is a ton of fun. Yes, 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 yes. Get yourself to a good or evil or digital newsagent and pick it up right now. It is a belter of an issue, folks. Okay, time now for our second guest. He is a man who has been making headlines this week for possibly all the wrong reasons, but I promise you that he doesn't say anything remotely controversial in our interview. It is, of course, Matt Damon, the star of Good Will Hunting, the good Jason Bourne films, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and now Stillwater, the new film from Tom McCarthy, in which he plays an American man who travels to Marseille to try and fight for the freedom of his daughter, who has been locked up for murder. Murder, 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 murder. Now, Helen, of course, was in Cannes recently. Matt Damon was also in Cannes recently.
Mm-hmm. Coincidence? I think not.
Have you ever seen us in the same room at the same time?
You are both Liam Neeson.
Talking about great disguises, right?
Yes. One of these two people is Dr. Peyton Westlake, but I'm not going to tell you which one it is. Anyway, Matt Damon was in Cannes, Helen was in Cannes, so naturally this interview was conducted on Zoom because Helen then had to come back to London on the day she was meant to interview Matt Damon. So it's all Helen's fault, really.
It was, it's not my fault they scheduled the interview for after I left, but it was a shame.
Yeah, it was a shame. But anyway, here we go. Helen talking to Matt Damon. Enjoy.
Hey everyone, it's Chris again, jumping in real quick before the Matt Damon interview begins, because this apparently is the week of people revealing spoilers about their own movies in their interviews. So I have now listened and edited the Matt Damon interview. There is a big old chunk of this interview where he and Helen discuss the end of the movie and what happens to his character in the film. So it's a short enough excerpt that I couldn't pull it out and put it into a spoiler special, and it's a big enough excerpt that I couldn't just cut it from the interview. So, once again, I would recommend that you do not listen to this unless you want to know what happens in Stillwater, and it is probably best to see Stillwater first and then come back and listen to the interview. I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I think that's a fair warning. So, it's a really fun interview. He's on good form. So here it is, Matt Damon talking to Helen, but spoilers, beware, enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire podcast. You know, I loved the film, first of all, I really enjoyed it. It, however, one of those roles where you're glad you're not paid by the word?
Yeah, that's funny. I haven't heard that one. It's funny, I didn't notice how little I talk. That subject has come up a lot on this during this junket this last week, and I didn't notice how little he talked, because it felt like he said exactly the right amount of words. I guess, you know, when you go going to Oklahoma and meeting these guys, you drive, like, to do this job, you have to drive these vast distances. Like, the rig might be 250 miles away, and those guys cover that like it's nothing. Like, those roads out in Oklahoma, there's nothing out there. It's flat, it's straight. And, you know, it's nothing for them to drive hundreds of miles to an oil rig to go to work. And so a couple of them will be in the car for hours and hours and not talk, you know? it's just, they're very comfortable not talking. Just tend to be, at least the guys we met were kind of men of few words, and that's what we wanted kind of Bill to be. He does talk when he has to, but he doesn't feel the need to talk all the time. He's very comfortable in silence.
Yeah, he's a really likeable guy. I mean, I feel like I've met Bills. I feel like I know, you know, Bills just in real life.
Yeah, me too.
But I mean, yeah. I mean, so you went out to Oklahoma though and met a lot of these guys, right? And you sort of got to see that character at work.
Yeah, yeah, and that was the most important thing we did because I didn't realize the kind of the specificity of this roughneck culture, and I mean, like it's a thing, like that job in particular. It's a really, really hard job to do, and not a lot of people can do it, and they're very proud that they do it. And like in Oklahoma, when you graduate high school, you either go to the oil fields or you go to college.
Right.
And so these roughnecks are kind of like rock stars. Like they get a lot of cash in their pocket. Like when the fields are up, they're making a lot of money. They're working incredibly hard, but they're walking around with a lot of cash. Mm. And so, you know, that leads can lead them down, you know, that addiction road pretty easily.
Yeah.
And that's a common story that you get from. So there's a whole kind of, that kind of runs the gamut. Like the guy that was taking us around, this guy, his name was Kenny Baker, is Kenny Baker. And that's why we named Bill Baker.
Because, oh, really?
Yeah. Cause we were so grateful to Kenny. But he's like on the far end of that spectrum where he's really got his act together. He's like, got a beautiful house and family and, you know, he's just really got everything, all the ducks in a row. And, you know, but there are guys, you know, these are other guys who you see at the job site who might be sleeping in their truck, you know, and just kind of keeping it together. And so we wanted Bill to be like somewhere kind of in between, but more towards that latter guy who, you know, who kind of got lost on that road, was drinking too much or using, and he was an absentee father. And so when he comes on the screen, you want to feel that guilt and shame and pain and regret.
Yeah.
And because of the way he's failed his daughter, he knows he has, and he feels this level of responsibility for her being where she is because he wasn't around. And so the story is about this guy who's trying to repair this thing that's really important to him, but doesn't, he wants to help her and doesn't have the tools, the skills to help, to be helpful. So I thought it was just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful script and heartbreaking at times and hopeful at times. And, you know, all the things that a complex movie should be. The fact that he then has this relationship with this woman and her daughter and is able to be the surrogate father to this 8-year-old kid, he's able to be the way he couldn't be with his own daughter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's going to go wrong. You can, you know, because, you know, he's going to mess it up. And I don't want to give too much away, but I still see kind of a lot of hope in the ending that like this guy's world has been opened up. I love that that last line, like that Tom Tomah Noé wrote, you know, like just, you know, she tells him everything looks the same and it's like, you know, no, you know, I get choked up thinking about it. It's like, it's really, I thought just really beautiful and hopeful in the sense that like he knows there's a bigger world out there. Mm. I mean, when we were shooting those scenes going back into his house, Bill's house, like we were just like, oh my God. Like Tom did something that was great, which was we shot all of the Oklahoma stuff at the end. So
we had
that whole Marseille experience, which is like 90% of the movie. And it was such a great and, you know, overwhelming and wonderful and, you know, messy and fun. And like, it was just such a great experience. And we had done those scenes in that apartment where you just open the windows and you're looking out at the Mediterranean. I mean, it was just so beautiful. And you're like, this is this guy's life. This is where this roughneck ended up. Like, wow. You know what I mean? And to lose that and go all and back into that, you know, that depressing house, you know. Like Tom and I walked in there and we looked at each other. We were like, oh God, like, can you imagine what this would feel like, you know, yeah. Once you had seen that. And once you'd fallen in love and loved this kid and all, you know, all that stuff. So anyway, it was, I'm glad he just shot it in that order, mostly because I never would have been able to do the scene. The lines are relatively simple. It's not a lot of lines, but to imbue them with the depth that they need, it really helped to have lived that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I went into this very pure. I watched it in Cannes. I was running around so much like a headless chicken. I hadn't even read a synopsis. So I kind of went in and was a little bit at sea at first. I'm like, who is this guy? Why is he going to France? What has he got there? And then when, you know, just because of your history, I was maybe wondering, is this going to be a sort of a, you know, dad comes in and fixes everything? And it's absolutely not that. This is the anti-born. This is not a guy who comes to a foreign country and disappears like a ghost.
Yeah. I mean, I always think of that line in Liam Neeson's movie Taken, where he says, I have a very particular set of skills. You know what I mean? Like this is the exact opposite of that guy. Like he has no tools, no skills. He can't speak the language. He doesn't understand the world around him. He doesn't understand the culture. He doesn't understand what's happening. It's a world that's leaving him behind. But he's got this overwhelming impulse to try to help his kid. And so he just keeps kind of pushing forward like a bull.
Yeah. Yeah, he's pretty unstoppable. I wanted to ask as well about just working with Lulu, because Tom said that you basically had the same kind of dynamic you have on screen. She doesn't speak a lot of English, I guess, and it was sort of a, you know, love across the languages situation.
Yeah, and she's just, this happens sometimes with kids that are just naturals. You know, you could have, two graduate students could have a long discussion about technique, about Lulu and what she's doing. She doesn't know any of those words, but it just doesn't matter. And the first day she worked, Tom says, I didn't remember this, but Tom told me that I came off set after her first take and walked over to the monitor and saw Tom and said, oh, so that's how it's going to be. You know, but I do remember at the end of the first day that she had gone home and we sat down together, Tom and I, and said, okay, like, how do we keep this fun and joyful for her? In America, we have this thing of a baseball player pitching a no hitter, a pitcher pitching a no hitter. And what happens is people, once they realize that it might be happening, they just get out of the pitcher's way because they want to make sure that they're not the thing that messes it up.
Yeah.
And we talked about making sure we clear out anybody who could potentially start whispering in her ear, or giving her notes or anything like that. We needed to clear the field for her and just keep it fun and just keep it really playful and light. And I have to say the French laws around minors working, while they're really hard on a production, they're really helpful because there's never any doubt. They're very strict, and she can only work for a few hours, and you know, that's it. That's good. I mean, she never burned out, and she always was happy to be there.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, speaking of sort of light and playful, I've got to ask a quick question. I mean, I know you were back for Thor: Love and Thunder, so you can't tell me anything about the film. I'm not even going to ask, but have you personally come up with an elaborate backstory about what your character has been up to during the blip, during everything that's happened since we last saw him? Have you worked on all of that enormously important stuff?
I did all my research. There's only so much I can tell you. I may or may not still be an intergalactic community theater actor. That's how I see him. So. Mm-hmm.
That sounds more fun than playing a full-on superhero and having to do months of training anyway.
Look, I have to tell you, like, I've never seen Chris train harder. I felt awful for him. He because he was, you know, they don't build it into his schedule because they have too much to shoot. So, you know, he's got to do that. And the amount of He and his stunt guy Bobby, they were just I've never seen them. It just they had to eat every whatever. I can't even know their schedule. It was just but it was really onerous. And I told him, I said, you looked great in the last one, man. Why don't you just do that again? Like, why'd you have to get bigger? I, you know, but anyway.
Yeah, well, listen, awesome. And thank you so much for talking to us. And yeah, like I said, love the film. Can't wait to see it again. And I'm just going to write my own fan fiction that Bill has a nice life and everything works out for him from here on out.
I agree with your fan fiction, by the way. I really do think it's hopeful at the end. I think he knows he lives in a bigger world. So he's going to be okay.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Okay, so that was Matt Damon. What a time to have Matt Damon on the podcast, eh, folks?
I didn't know he was going to be controversial.
Stop being controversial, Matt Damon. How do you like lem apples? Anyway, we're going to talk about Stillwater in just a few minutes. But first up, Sola. Not Emile, not Gianfranco, just Sola. Explain what Sola is, or who Sola is, if you will, James Dyer.
Indeed. So if anyone was on Twitter in 2015, they will have seen or at least heard about the tweet from Zola King. She posted a 148 tweet thread, yes indeed, about an ill-fated road trip to Florida.
See, I was on Twitter, as you know, I'm on Twitter constantly. Didn't see that thread, had never heard of that thread until this movie came out.
Hashtag the story. Yes, I have both heard of it and read it, and it is fucking wild. And this has to be, to the best of my knowledge, the first film based on a Twitter thread. So the
Come
idea
on.
Is...
Indeed. I did the World Cup of TV theme tunes. Pick that up.
Perhaps they will, Chris. Perhaps they will. Give it time. So Taylor Page plays Zola, and she is a kind of a waitress and a part-time stripper working in Detroit. And one day, Stephanie... played by Riley Keough, comes in and starts chatting to her while she's working. She's a stripper. She's a stripper. They get on. They decide to strip together. They have a night where they kind of bond in a kind of like sisterly fun way. And Stephanie says, hey, why don't you come with me on a road trip to Florida? My friend made like $5,000 in a night stripping at this club. Let's go. It'll be great. We're going to go with my boyfriend and my roommate. And she's like, who's your roommate? And Stephanie is quite vague about it. And that should have been warning sign number one. So they go out. I mean, it's absolutely deranged. It's more deranged because this is mainly true. I think there's a certain amount of embellishment in the original Twitter thread, and there's a few more liberties taken in this film. I think partly because the Twitter thread goes to some really fucking dark places, which the film really didn't want to go to. It's pretty dark, but it could have been a lot darker. Certainly the end of the Twitter thread is a curveball. But what's interesting about this to me, so this is directed by Janisca Bravo. This film came within a hair's breadth of being directed by James Franco, and I can't get my head around that as a concept. Obviously, the, shall we say, allegations and incidents came out, and he is no longer attached to the project, but this is very much a female story about a female experience, a none more female experience, and I just can't get my head around having a male filmmaker sort of driving this. But as it happens, it works out very well. I think it's really well directed. I think the story is very well told. It's also brilliantly cast. I think both Keough and Page are almost supernaturally unflappable in their characters here, especially Keough in this role as this sort of stripper who's, you know, turning tricks on the side, and she is completely level-headed. She cannot be swayed from anything. It's quite extraordinary. And all the way through this sort of wild ride, this sort of crazy road trip where everything's going from bad to worse, Zola is trying to sort of keep a lid on everything and stop everything going to shit. And I think watching her self-possession through this, it's like a masterclass in how to keep calm under fire. It's very, very entertaining. You've also got in here Nicholas Braun from Succession, as well as Derek, the slightly hapless boyfriend, and Coleman Domingo as X, who is Stephanie's quote-unquote roommate. So, okay, it's, as I said, it's got lots of good elements to it. My issues with this, I found this, the tone of this didn't sit brilliantly with me, and this may just be that it's not my sort of film. I think certainly as a kind of a look into, frankly, the shit that women have to deal with from awful, awful men, it's incredibly well executed and well told. I found it quite, sordid isn't quite the word, but I found it quite depressing. It kind of brought me down, the whole film did. I found it, it's not a long film, it's only an hour and a half, it's really, really tight, but I did find it a bit of a slog, just because from a mood thing, I found it emotionally exhausting to get through the film, and I think I struggled with it a little bit. Also, I think problematically, having read the thread already, I found that some of the more, shall we say, eye-opening, crazy moments, they had tweaked, for tonal reasons in the film, which I think was a little bit disappointing. Generally speaking, great film, really well made. But also, I would say read the Twitter thread, because the Twitter thread is just fucking wild.
Yeah, I thought as well, great, great performances. It looked really stunning. I thought the cinematography of this was
very well shot.
Was really stunning, and design and everything. When there's a real shift as they move through Florida, you can sort of trace the emotion of the story through the sets, through the lighting, through the color choices, and Taylor Page in particular. I hadn't seen her in maybe anything before, but same. She owns the screen here. She absolutely gobbles it up. She's fantastic. Mm. But it is about really uncomfortable topics. It's about sex work and exploitation and, some quite dangerous situations that these women are thrust into. So it's very tense a lot of the time, and which is not a criticism, but it just be ready, be aware, because this is not a relaxing film to watch. But yeah, I liked it. I liked it. I'm not rushing to watch it again because I did find it incredibly stressful.
It is really, really stressful. It's quite interesting as well, because when you read it as a Twitter thread, it's just like, oh my God, this is hilarious. And I think the emotional range of reading that and then watching the film are quite distinct from each other, which is maybe why it threw me slightly.
Yeah, really, I have to say I really liked it. But can we just give a shout out to Colman Domingo, who is having one heck of a year. And he is fantastic in this movie. As I was watching the movie, I was thinking, this could be one of those kind of unsung Oscar performances going right here, almost unnoticed under your nose. So Colman Domingo is he's in Fear the Walking Dead. He's Victor Strand in Fear the Walking Dead. He is a playwright. Absolutely. He's a writer in his own right as well, but he's having a heck of a year. So he was in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom alongside Taylor Page earlier in the year. Fantastic in that. Fantastic in this. He was in Without Remorse for 2 minutes, but we won't hold that against him. He's in a good film called The God Committee, which is Judith Stiles and Kelsey Grammer, which is out soon, I believe, on VOD. And he's going to be coming up soon in Candyman. And I've interviewed him a couple of times over the last 18 months or so, and he is whip smart, very, very funny, doesn't take himself too seriously. And I think this movie could be one of those, one of those indie contenders for Oscar. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him. It reminded me a lot of Something Wild. The Jonathan Demme film, Something Wild. It reminded me an awful lot where you have an innocent person getting in way over their heads. But Colman Domingo is great in this. He's charismatic. He's terrifying. His character, he does this really interesting thing where he switches between an American accent and an African, I think it's Nigerian accent, at the drop of a hat when he wants to intimidate someone. And it's just a really, really nicely played, calibrated performance. We gave us 1 3-star, which is, of course, a recommendation. 3 stars for Sola.
If nothing else, they should nominate Colman Domingo because he's the best dressed man on the red carpet.
He really is.
He can carry a fuchsia suit. I mean,
yeah,
that is a high level of difficulty right there.
The hot dog costume from I Think You Should Leave? He could make that work.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Or any of the disguises that we talked about earlier on, like Inspector Clouseau's country bumpkin suit. Colman Domingo could make that fly. So cast Colman Domingo and everything is basically what I'm taking away from this. 3 stars then for Sola. And no spoilers to say that we also gave 3 stars to Stillwater. But Helen, was that deserved? Tell us about it. Obviously, you're in the pocket of Big Damon, having interviewed him and Tom McCarthy. But tell us about it anyway.
Yeah, no, I really like this. And I'm beginning to wonder, like, am I out on a limb here?
Because I liked it too.
It's been pretty mixed up reviews. So yes, this is the story about, we meet this guy who is an Oklahoma kind of roughneck. He works in the oil trade. He is, interviewing for new jobs. But first he has to go off to France. And at first we're a little bit unclear as to why this guy is headed to Marseille. And he seems to know the town. He knows the people. And it becomes clear that basically he's there because his daughter is in prison and he has been visiting her, during her trial. And now that she's inside, he's still obviously keeping up the visits, bringing her the luxuries that she's allowed, taking away washing and bringing it back to her, which is a fascinating detail of French prison life. And so he's visiting her quite regularly. She's played by Abigail Breslin. But she tells him on this particular visit that she has, new evidence. She has something new, a new lead that might lead them to reopen the case. And he's basically determined to try and fix this for her and try and, get the case reopened, get an appeal going, get her out of prison. And so he essentially settles down in Marseille for a bit to look for this new witness that she thinks she's found and try and get the case reopened and essentially starts a new life for himself there. But that sets up questions because ultimately it might come down to a choice between his daughter and his new life and what's he going to do when it comes to that. So it becomes this really interesting character study of a guy. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the backdrop to the case and the fact that it was inspired by the detail of the Amanda Knox saga that she went through. And she has gone on Twitter and said, look, they should have talked to me. If they're going to take something that draws so firmly from my life, I should be involved, which is a very compelling point that I think a lot of Hollywood films have never considered before. And I think maybe there will be more talk about that in future. But that's kind of background to this story. This story is actually about the dad character, the father character. It's not about the prison and it's not about Abigail Breslin particularly. It's more a character study of him about whether he can do right by his daughter as he sees it, undo some of his failures in the past as a father and somehow do that without spoiling his new life and his new kind of the new sense that he might have found something worthwhile in France. And he is completely ill-equipped to do any of this. He is not Jason Bourne. He is not someone who's going to go out and knock heads and find answers and who's going to blend seamlessly into the local populace. You know, this is a redneck guy in the middle of Marseille, completely at a loss for most of the time. And so it's that I find quite compelling. This fish out of water who is trying to do the right thing and quite often failing, basically, according to everyone else in his life. So I just really like that. I just really liked kind of getting into this world with this character and having him fumble his way through it. And it seemed to me a really interesting way to approach a story like this, a really interesting tale that I hadn't seen before. The performances are all great. You know, Matt Damon, whatever his other problems that he might have right now, is a very good actor. Abigail Breslin's great and much more kind of intense than a lot of the roles we've seen her in before. Camille Cotin from Call My Agent is fantastic as Virginie, who's the French actress and single mother who kind of helps Damon through this kind of quest of his. But it's just about their relationships. It's just about this weird situation. It's about this strange fish trying to fix things as he sees it and usually failing. And I just really, really like that. I thought McCarthy did a really good job.
Yeah. Because yeah, I think you go into this with expectations of one film, which is Taken 4, and you don't get that because, you know, there's an example of a previous movie in which a brash American goes to Marseille and doesn't exactly conform or adapt to the local ways. And that movie is French Connection 2. And that this is not French Connection 3 either. So it's much more of a considered drama. And I guess naturally, because it's Tom McCarthy and that's what he does for the most part. And I liked it too. I thought it was really well acted and compelling and evolving. But we gave it 3 stars, which is, of course, a recommendation. I think Helen and I might go a little bit higher on that one. But, you know, hey-ho.
Leaving aside some of those issues of context, which have been troubling, I think it's a really good film in its own right. Yeah.
That's a bigger conversation, though, as well, because as you rightly point out, this is not the Amanda Knox story. And I am unsettled as a big fan of, say, Law & Order and Law & Order SVU, which regularly just pull stories from the headlines, change some of the names and change some of the details and then build an entire episode around it. That always feels a little bit ethically icky to me. So it's interesting, you know, where do you draw the line on stuff like this? But judging the movie as a movie on its own merits, we gave it 3 stars. 3 stars then for Still Water. Next up is an Irish comedy horror called The Boys from County Hell. James, welcome to County Hell. James, did you understand anything that happened in this movie?
Liberate, tutame, ex infernis. Save me from The Boys from County Hell. Now, this is from writer-director Chris Bohr, and it's a kind of Irish folktale / vampire story with a twist. Instead of focusing on the classic Nosferatu, it focuses on the myth of the Abertach, which I'm almost certainly mispronouncing. But that is an Irish vampire story, and the idea is that friends Eugene and William, played by Jack Rowan and Fra Fee, are talking about their lives and possibly getting out of rural Ireland. And there's a big old cairn in a big old field that houses a big old monster that everyone seems to know about, but it's the hub of the sort of local myth. And, you know, vampire hunters and Bram Stoker fans come to see this sort of cairn where the Irish vampire is. Just a big old stack of stones with a Bram skull on the top, but still. Unfortunately, one night, someone inadvertently awakens the Abatach.
No, that's the last thing you want to do.
Absolutely. And then you get people bleeding out of their eyes and indeed their penises, absolutely true, while the blood is consumed by this demonic creature. So this is an interesting kind of, I guess, different take on the classic vampire myth, because vampire stuff can get very, very hoary, and it's nice to see this done slightly differently. Now, this does try very hard to straddle that, let's be honest, quite difficult line of doing comedy horror and doing it well. Like someone like Werewolves Within, which we reviewed recently, did that brilliantly. You know, someone like Shaun of the Dead, it's walking that line, but making it both funny, but also poignant and maybe a little bit scary as well. I think the main problem with this is it doesn't commit well enough to either one. So it's not particularly scary. And bar one particular gag with a severed leg, I did not find it funny either. I don't think it really leans into the comedy enough. I think a lot of the comedy just doesn't land. So S.P. McCauley, who plays Michael, one of their friends, is the kind of, he's like the comedy friend in the group, but doesn't seem to have any good lines or jokes. And you're kind of waiting for the comedy to kickstart all the way through this, or for the horror to really ramp up. But bar a few jump scares, there's not an awful lot here. I think Bohr tries very hard to give each of these characters some decent inner life. Like the relationship, John Lynch is in here as Fra Fee character's father. That relationship's an interesting one. Eugene's father, the relationship he has because they've lost their mother, is also another one which feels fleshed out. There is an inner life there. But it's kind of, I found I couldn't really engage with the character's backstories when I just didn't really care what was going on around it. So ultimately, even though this, again, is a pretty short film, it's only an hour and a half, I was a little bit bored and did not love it, sadly. So the Abatach did not seize me.
Yeah, I feel like it needed another pass on the script as well, just to really sharpen the comedy and the horror. Because I thought there were some really, like you say, really good ideas with, it is a different kind of monster than we've seen before. There are some things there that you could explore that I think they mostly don't. And I think it takes an awfully long time for the horror to get going. And then you kind of want a bit more than you maybe get. So I really wanted, obviously I wanted to love it. It's a Northern Irish horror comedy. I mean, like, how many of those do you get per year? But it's just everything just felt like it was just a little bit more blunt and less polished than it should have been to really, really take off and sing. And all the elements were kind of there. I just felt like it just wasn't 100% landing its punches, if you like. Yeah.
Hapless road workers versus vampires just seems like it could have been mined for comedy gold.
I had some, there were some fun moments and there were some clever little ideas in it. But yeah, for me, I just wanted it to be greater than it was. I will say also, even as a Northern Irish person, there were lines I couldn't make out. So 100%. Maybe just another pass in ADR might have helped as well.
Is it now, Helen? Is it my done? Cheers.
There's a wee bit of that, to be honest.
There is a bit of that in there. There is a bit in there. We gave this one 4 stars in the magazine.
4 stars. Four stars in the Empire magazine. No, for the
I think our reviewer enjoyed it a lot more than Helen and I did.
Jesus, no, Lord. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, you enjoyed it a lot more than these guys at the end of freaking ages. 4 stars down for the boys from County Hill. Next up in the Empire podcast is another film. It's called The Last Letter from Your Lover. And it's got Felicity Jones in it. Felicity Jones in it. Who else is in it? The old woman. Shailene Woodley. Shailene Woodley's in the film. And your fellow, Callum Turner. He's a lovely fella. Lovely fella, Callum Turner. No one else in this podcast has seen this film, so I'll tell you about it very quickly. It's a romantic melodrama. It's based on a novel by Jojo Moyes. Lovely Jojo Moyes. Great film. Great film. Great author. Lovely. Writes a lot of stuff on the keyboard. Great keyboard. Loud. Typing skills. Very, very fast. 90 words a minute. Anyway, so it's a film about a journalist who is played by Felicity Jones. And sorry, I just had to slap myself there. And Felicity Jones plays a journalist who is given an obituary to write on someone who has just died. And in the course of doing that, finds a mysterious love letter from two people whose identities cannot be ascertained from this 1960s, suggesting that it was some sort of extramarital affair. Oh, what's happening? Ooh. And so she starts to dig into it, and then we flit back and forth between the modern day and the 60s, where we see Joe Alwyn and Shailene Woodley are in a fairly loveless marriage. She's recovering from amnesia amnesia following a recent car accident and can't remember anything. Meanwhile, Callum Turner is a lovelorn man who may or may not have been involved with her pre the accident. And so it's all about all this stuff coming together and all these various strands coming together. And there's a fair amount of just coming together in this as well. It's not raunchy in that way, but there's some, intercourse. That's what I'm saying. Anyway, this is based on the novel by Jojo Moyes, in case you didn't understand what I was saying earlier on. This is The Last Letter from Your Lover. I haven't read the book, but my understanding is it's a very, very good adaptation of the book. And I enjoyed it for what it is, which is basically the British Nick the Sparks. And it's well acted, winningly so, I would say, by everyone involved. The modern day section, in which Felicity Jones embarks upon a flirtation with Naban Riswan's researcher Rory, is also pretty charming. It is a trifle of a movie. It is a light trifle of a movie directed by Augustine Frizzell. We gave this 2 stars, but if you're feeling particularly generous, or if you're one of those people who just likes to watch a nice romantic drama between people who look pretty and gaze lovingly into each other's eyes, then check it out, The Last Letter from Your Lover.
Thank God you finished that thought and didn't just leave it there. If you like to watch, that was close.
Oh, I like to watch, Helen.
Oh, God.
I said there was a comma there. There was a comma. I like to watch, comma,
like
Helen.
To watch
I don't
Helen.
Like to watch Helen.
Oh, no. Oh,
oh Lord.
God.
This has gone
God.
Very badly. Should we talk very, very, very quickly about Fivo?
Yes, we shall. This is the Sony Pictures animation musical that's on Netflix this week. All new original songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who we've never talked about in this podcast before.
No.
But I guess there's a first time for everything.
There is.
And he also voices a small Kikaju monkey called Vivo, who has been raised by a Cuban musician who's voiced by Juan de Marcos González, who is, of course, from Buena Vista Social Club. And then through a series of events that I won't get too much into because I don't want to spoil anything, he ends up basically having to go on a journey with a small girl called Gabby, who's adorable and weird and fantastic, to get a thing to a person in Miami. So he has to go on this mad journey through the Florida Everglades, basically, to get this thing to this person. It's very silly. I am not a huge fan of animated films about animals, which I think I've talked about before. Give me Aladdin over the Lion King any day of the week. Mm-hmm. Having said that, everybody in this is cute. The songs are good. And, it's bouncy and colorful and runs along nicely. So you could do a lot worse. And with the school holidays on, you can probably be very grateful that this exists and you can plonk the kids in front of it for an hour and a half.
There you go. Can't say fairly that. 6 stars then for Fivo, sounds like. No, we gave it 3.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fun. It hasn't stuck with me beyond some of the music. So I would say about 3 for me.
Feels like we've given, everything's got a bit of a middling review this week. But I really liked Sola and Stillwater. And if you don't like those, if nothing there floats your boat, you can always go back and rewatch The Suicide Squad. Or not. You can do what you want. I'm not your boss. You have free will, listeners. You can do whatever you want. But anyway, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. So last week was a live show, and we are back again doing another live show in September at the London Podcast Festival, and tickets are on sale for that right now, and that will be live streamed. So we didn't live stream last week's show for a number of reasons, but we will be live streaming the show in London on September 11th. So if you cannot get a ticket to that, or you don't fancy a ticket to see us live in the room, and I totally understand if you don't, because obviously we're still in the middle of a pandemic, and you want to see us broadcast out that live, then you can do so. That will not be, as far as I'm aware, a regular episode of the podcast. So the only way you'll be able to see that show, as with last year's London Podcast Festival show, will be through the stream or in person. So go to kingsplace.co.uk for more information and to buy tickets. And also, I should point out as well that we've done a number of additional podcasts recently. We did, James and Beth Webb and I did a celebration of The Walking Dead, which is available. It's a lot of fun to listen to. So go and check that one out if you haven't already. And we launched last week, our new limited edition series is running for just 6 weeks, one per week. It's called Celebration of Cinema.
And every week I talk to a notable figure from the world of film about their favourite cinema-going memories. We started off with Olga Kurylenko. Next Tuesday will be David Arnold. The week after that will be Assam Chowdhury, star of People Just Do Nothing. The week after that, Simon Pegg. And the week after that, and the week after that, TBC. But there are going to be some great names, so listen to that. That's going to be out every single Tuesday. Spoiler specials are coming thick and fast on the spoiler special feed. Black Widow just went up. We're doing Fear Street, the Fear Street trilogy with director Lee Janiak. We have Cruella and Fast 9 coming your way very, very soon as well. So if you haven't already subscribed, now would be the perfect time to do so and get some of that Tom Hiddleston Loki content into your ears as well. Anyway, I'm not going to be around next week, so you're going to have to join Helen and James for more film-related fun.
Party!
Party, indeed. Because I am taking what I am reliably informed is a week off, and I'm only going to be checking my email 4 times a day, and I'm only going to be writing 3 features and editing 10 podcasts. So it's nice and easy, nice and relaxing time. Going back to Northern Ireland, Helen.
Hurrah! Fantastic. You'll be stocking up on the Vita bread then.
Indeed, I will be clutching Vita bread to my breast. My accent will be getting considerably stronger. But anyway, join Helen and James and someone else next week whenever they will be joined by Jeffrey Wright, a.k.a. Uatu, the Watcher, the voice, the chief voice of Marvel's animated series, What If, which launches next week on Disney Plus.
And which we'll be reviewing on the next episode of the Pilot TV podcast, available on Monday.
And we'll also be joined by Jodie Comer, the star of Free Guy. Can't say fairer than that. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my two colleagues of such lethal cunning, the Abortak himself, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Christopher.
Goodbye, James. Enjoy next week. It is goodbye from Fever Dog, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Solid Stillwater reference.
Yeah.
Yes.
I like it a lot.
I have a Stillwater reference in my name. Do you think you can spot it?
No. Yeah.
Because it's goodbye from me, Stillwater, Run Deep.
Yeah, I see what you did there.
It's implying that I have depths. I have so many depths. I have hidden depths. I have depths you motherfuckers haven't even seen.
Experience. Well, that's true. We've never seen them. No. That's true.
Been no real evidence of that. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You'll see them. You'll see them. Oh, God, again, that sounded more threatening than intended. Anyway, that is it for me. I'm off to watch every single movie we saw this week and try and find Dr. Peyton Westlake. He's hiding in there somewhere. I'll find you, Peyton. I'll find you. Thanks for listening.
See you next week.
Bye.